Before we say anything, I'd like to thank Elizabeth for choosing that last hymn. I didn't choose the hymn this morning. That one, as you'll see, is particularly appropriate. In recent years, there have been a lot of translations of early Christian works published. The most recent one to hit the presses was the Gospel of Judas. And many of these early Christian works are, as that one is, they're entitled Gospels. There's a Gospel of Thomas, which has been around for a long time and is quite famous and discussed by many people. And there's a Gospel of Philip, and this Gospel of Judas, and several others, and they're all entitled, many of them are entitled Gospels. And so this has raised an issue among the church historians and textual scholars of why we have the particular books that we do have in our New Testament. What has gone into actually choosing the books of the New Testament? Why weren't the others included? And it's interesting as a, you know, scholarly question, and I rather enjoy looking at these writings and thinking about them. But there's one question which is never raised, or at least I have never found it in all of the paper that I have read on this topic, and that's the question of whether God had something to do with choosing the writings that we find in our New Testament. Did God have something to do with what we nowadays think of as the canon of the New Testament? Because, you see, that raises an interesting question, and a very profound and a very searching question. If God did have something to do with choosing these books, then maybe God had something to do with the content of those books. And if God had something to do with the content of those books, then maybe God wants us to think about what's in those books. Because even though they were written 2,000 years ago almost, surely we in our day should be able to find something in them which is relevant to our society, if so be God had a hand in developing the content of our New Testaments. Now, we should never underestimate the importance of the dedication of the people who compiled these books. Many of the Old Testament prophets went through very difficult periods in Jewish history when they were active. Many of them, Jeremiah, for instance, was thrown into a pit on one occasion. They went through very difficult times in propounding the message that they had to sell. And sell is a very modern word, but they had to do it even in those days. And more than that, to simply spend time writing and copying and disseminating these words was in many instances a very unpopular activity. So we should never underestimate the dedication. And there's a significant exhortation there, isn't there? For people who went out of their way amid considerable difficulties in the period of history in which they lived to see that we had this copy. And then let's go back to the question which we raised at the start. Did God have something to do with the content of these books? Well, it's interesting that there's an almost seamless transition from the Gospel of John into the Acts of the Apostles. And one of the ways that this happens, of course, is that in the middle of the last chapter of John, Jesus appeared to his disciples, and he confronted Peter on three separate occasions with the one specific question. And it comes out, first of all, is, do you love me? To put it in modern English, said Jesus to Peter, do you love me? Peter gave a very short answer on that first occasion, and Jesus responded to him then, because he had said, yes, I do, in so many words. Jesus responded and said, well, feed my lambs. Well, Jesus answered that same question of Peter on two more occasions, and each time he answered it, the question got more involved, more searching, and it became more annoying to Peter that he should be asked this question more than once. Why do you need to ask me? You can hear this. in Peter's response. Why do you keep asking me this? Yes, I do. My conviction is still the same, Peter seems to be saying. I'm still as committed to you as I ever was. And we can read all sorts of little ideas like this in Peter's response. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. And feed my sheep. On those two additional occasions. And then when we turn over into the Acts of the Apostles, we find in the 13th verse a rather interesting little list of people. And Peter is at the front of that list. And at the end of that list, or almost at the end of it, are Jesus' brothers. And just before we read about Jesus' brothers, we have Jesus' mother mentioned. We have the mother and the children. They're present together with Peter, away from the crowds in sort of quietness, on their own. And they're all together. And then in the 15th verse, Peter stood up. And there were, it says, about 120 of them present. And Peter stood up and began to take his place as the dominant evangelist in the beginnings of the development of the church. So we have already seen then two ways in which we get from this notion of feed my sheep was said to Peter, and the way that transpired when we work our way through the Acts of the Apostles. Because as we work through the Acts of the Apostles, we find that it was not just the words of Peter or Paul or Barnabas that were important, but there were many ways in which others contributed to the welfare and the well-being of that community in those early years. And so this matter of keeping the group together, of looking after them in both a physical and a spiritual sense, is demonstrated for us in the Acts. And so there are many ways in which we can take the message that Jesus gave to Peter to our hearts. It's not merely to those who stand up on a Sunday morning, as I am at this moment, and try to give you something of meaning from the Scriptures. There are many ways that we can contribute to one another's welfare, and they're demonstrated for us in the Acts. So, if we ask the question again, did God have something to do with the contents of the book? I think we can indicate that yes, indeed, there was, at least in this respect, the hand of God involved. And as we work through the Acts of the Apostles, we realize that there are many ways in which we in our day can take to heart the words that are there for us in the Acts, and the different ways in which the apostles looked after one another and realized that that message is just as important and just as significant in these days as it was in the first century. Now, last week, we talked about Lazarus from this platform. And the message of the raising of Lazarus was made quite clear. And this was a prelude to the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. And it was a physical demonstration that God has authority in the lives of men. And it was pointed out to us that the question was raised of Jesus on at least three occasions in that chapter, 11th chapter of John, that if Jesus had been there, Lazarus could have been kept alive. And what do we read in there? Well, we read the evidence, as our brother last week pointed out, that these miracles had meaning. The miracles of healing all had not just an immediate meaning, but they all had a lasting memory. If you had a very sick individual, and we talk a lot about this in our society nowadays, there's a great deal of stress on what we nowadays call the caregivers. And you realize then that those who had looked after these sick individuals would certainly remember the situation that they were in. And those who were aware of these family interactions would realize what that sick individual had gone through. And there would be plenty of people who knew the difference in people's lives when someone who they had to look after on a daily basis because they had difficulty looking after themselves was finally free of the illness that had constrained them. That was the point which was raised last week, that those miracles meant something and they had a lasting memory. They went on in time. And so the witness of those miracles stayed with the group for some time. But when you come to the miracles, most of which are recorded in John, several of them have no real lasting memory. There was, of course, one that did, and that's in the ninth chapter, and that's where Jesus cured a man of blindness. And he made clay and put it on the man's eyes and told him to go away and wash in the pool of Siloam. And when he did this, he was cured of his blindness. When that individual washed in that pool, his blindness was removed. And he could see. We have an interesting little comment then of this. The temple authorities then, because the pool of Siloam wasn't far from the temple, what was going on was certainly well known to the people who were there in the temple. And these people said, well, what's gone on? You know, they wanted to talk to this young fellow who had had his blindness cured. What's gone on? What's happened? And we find out as you work your way down through that event what was really going on here. They said, we don't believe you. And he said, well, yes, I really was blind. And so they said, well, prove it. And he produced his parents. And his parents came and said, yes, definitely our son has been blind for a long time. And now he can see. And the priest said to him, well, who did it? And they said, well, we don't know. We don't know who did it. Why did they say that? And the answer comes right in the very next verse when you read your way down through the story. That because if anyone proclaimed Jesus to be a prophet, they would be thrown out of the synagogue. What was going on here? Well, if you follow the notion of the Sadducees and the way that word is used through the New Testament, you find that they were there often listening to Jesus. They were there to see whether Jesus was indeed a prophet. Because if he was a prophet, his words should be recorded and should be retained within the temple library. But they had already decided that what Jesus was saying and doing was dangerous to the fragile peace which was there between them and the Romans. And so they could not admit that Jesus was a prophet. And that's why the word prophet is used at that point. And not some other, not a healer, not a word like that. Because they had to reject Jesus as being a prophet. It's interesting that in the early 1950s, I don't remember the year exactly, but there was a big tent set up in the site of, and I don't remember exactly where it was, you know, it's a long time ago, but it was probably in what is now the site of a Pentecostal church on Cook Street, which is down Cook Street down towards Pandora. And there was a faith healer came to town, and Josie and I were, as they say, going around together at that time, and we went down to see what this faith healer would come up with. Now, two things. Firstly, how did we know that the faith healer was coming to town? I don't remember what the advertising was, but there must have been. We knew it was going to happen, and that was why we went. And the other thing was that this was an enormous great tent. An enormous great tent. And there must have been a couple of hundred or more people in that tent. And I remember one woman sort of throwing down her walking sticks and taking a few steps. And I can't remember many of the other things that happened. But there we were. Everybody was happy and delirious because there was some healing going on. A faith healer was in action. how different that was. How different from what Jesus did. Jesus suppressed this crowd appeal. Why? Why? One of the reasons was that the miracles which Jesus did, many of them had a lasting memory in the people who were most affected. Those healing miracles did. But there's two miracles in the beginning of John, as we said, and we're going to look at them now for a few minutes, which don't really come with a lasting memory. And the first is styled in the second chapter of John as this first of all miracles which Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. And now, of course, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the time when there was a wedding feast and the servants came, interestingly, came to Jesus' mother. Interestingly, they went to Jesus' mother and said, "We've run out of wine." And Jesus' mother responded, "Go to Jesus. And whatever Jesus tells you to do, do that." Now, a couple of years ago, the young brother who's now presiding raised this point in one of his exhortations. And he raised that as the turning point in this miracle. Whatsoever he says unto you, do it. And as it was on that occasion, it's another very pointed and very significant exhortation, isn't it? What Jesus tells us to do it? Do we fit it into our lives the way the brethren in the first century did in their communities? You see, this was a very forgettable miracle. Not many people knew about it in the first place. The man who is styled in my translation, the governor of the feast, said, "This is really good wine. Why did we keep it until the very end? Why didn't we start with this?" He didn't know that what had happened was that the water jars which were used to wash people when they came to the feast had been refilled, and that these jars which were filled with water had then been poured, and it was wine that came out. There's a New Testament commentator who was a former Anglican minister who wrote a book entitled Water into Wine. And he doesn't believe that any of these miracles actually occurred. What he says is that it couldn't possibly happen. You can't put water into a bottle, turn the bottle over, and have wine come out. "I don't believe it," says Tom Harper. But it does teach a profound spiritual message. And that's the point that he makes. What point do we make? Do we see in a miracle like that God is in control of the world in which we live? Do we see the power of God, which we have evidence for us in the beginnings of Genesis, mirrored here in a little thing like this? And do we see in a miracle which almost nobody knew about? But the comment is there when you get to the end of the discussion of this miracle that the disciples believed. A few people knew. A few people were touched by the detail of what had happened. And a few people took away what they were supposed to take away in that miracle. They took away the belief that Jesus was here, come from God, the Son of God. That's what Matthew says. That these miracles were done to validate. To validate, if I may use that modern word, to validate the teachings of Jesus. The next and the really interesting thing happens when you get just two verses past the ending verse of this miracle. The disciples believed, it said. And then there's a couple of little verses which really don't say very much other than a few little while past. And then comes another verse which says, and the Passover of the Jews was at hand. There are three separate Passovers mentioned in John's Gospel. This is the first one. When Jesus provided wine for a wedding feast, when Jesus and his family were there in a group gathering, and Jesus contributed in a physical way to that gathering and made it a happy occasion. And so we can see the input of Jesus into our everyday activities, as well as the idea which is coming, because when Jesus provided the wine, first John turns over and says, and shortly after that came the Passover. Do you remember where the next Passover is? It's just two chapters later on, which is interesting because John condenses a whole year of Jesus' life into about 2.5 chapters. And then there's another year of Jesus' life, which is collapsed into about 4 chapters, the next one. But the next Passover feast is immediately a prelude to the time when Jesus fed the 5,000. And you can see a spiritual lesson being built in John's Gospel here. Wine was provided and the Passover was at hand. The Passover was at hand and Jesus provided bread for 5,000 people. And again, it was a forgettable miracle. And that point is made shortly afterward. So Jesus, to people who gathered around him, you've come here not because you really want to hear what I have to say, but because you think you might get a free meal. That was the depth of the understanding that Jesus expected from most of those who were chasing after him at that time. But the disciples, and this was the comment made at that miracle again, those who were closest to Jesus and who listened carefully and who were aware of what was going on and made themselves aware of this, they believed and they were affected by what Jesus did on that occasion. I don't want to say any more about that. We'll end up taking a long time. Let's go on now to John 13. And this is the third Passover, which is mentioned in John. Now, most Bible commentators put together the Gospels and say that the ministry of Jesus must have been about 3.5 years. But you see, there are just three Passovers, and the third Passover comes almost immediately before Jesus was killed. So John is not so much concerned then with the passage of time, because there's only 2 years between this first and the third Passover. There's at least another year somewhere, as most people seem to feel the message of Jesus was entailed. So John was less concerned with marking time by talking about these Passovers than he was about linking the concept of Passover to what was going on. And we'll come to this a little more in a few moments. It's a spiritual message in addition to the physical things which were done. For Jesus looked after the progress of that wedding feast, and he looked after the physical requirements of people for a meal when he fed that 5,000. But now, before the feast of Passover, in the beginning of the 13th chapter of John, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own. Right at the end of John, where we started out, Jesus turned to Peter and he said, "Do you love me?" In so many words, those are not exact words in my translation, but that's what it boils down to. Do you love me, Peter? Repeated it, "Do you really?" "Are you sure?" in so many words, was what Jesus said to Peter. It's interesting that was what was going on here. in this upper room, that Jesus was demonstrating his commitment to those who had followed him, to those who had been with him in the wedding at Cana. And we're told there that the disciples and his Jesus were both invited. To those who were closest to him when the 5,000 were fed, that Jesus was demonstrating what he had for them. Supper being over, the devil now put into the heart of Judas to betray him. And then the story goes on, and our presiding brother will no doubt read words to us to remind us of the events which happened there. But Gospel of John then is collapsed more into spiritual messages. The wine was prepared, and we were asked to think about Passover. The people were fed, physically fed. And we were asked to remember that Passover was near at hand. And at the Passover, Jesus gathered his disciples together because he loved them. At the end of Luke, there's a little comment, and the scholars who analyze the text of the Bible have trouble with this. It's called the walk to Emmaus in our parlance. And the thing that commentators have so much trouble with was the idea that people could walk with Jesus for some length of time and not recognize him. How is it that you didn't recognize him? Because they didn't. What it says was that he was recognized in the breaking of bread. The way Jesus took the bread into his hands when they shared that evening meal and broke it and gave each some of the bread that was part of that meal. That was the thing that they realized had to be Jesus. Whether or not they had seen Jesus do it or not, we're not told that. We're told that they were disciples, yes. But we're not told how closely they were associated with Jesus during his life on earth. So there are ways of discussing this issue that the commentators make, that how could you walk with him for so long and not know it was Jesus? But the point that I want to raise out of this is that that became a standard activity in the first century church. They gathered together in the evening. They broke bread the way Jesus had when he had his disciples with him in the evenings, and they shared their evening meal. And at that same time, they remembered the impact, and that's a modern word, the impact that Jesus had in their lives. They realized the force that Jesus had for them in their lives, and that caused them to write down the things that they had experienced. They realized that it was important for them to stay together as a group. And they realized that they had to contribute to one another's well-being and sustain one another as needed as time went on. And they realized that they shared all things in common. And as they did that, they remembered their Lord. And so they took out of this sharing of an evening meal the ideas that we should face now, that Jesus should be part of our lives on a continuing basis, and that when we remember him in the bread and wine, we should remember that Jesus not only provided this as a spiritual reminder, but he also did it because it was important to look after one another physically. And the greater lesson from that is that God provides for us on a daily basis, doesn't he? That the earth is sufficient for all of our needs. But if it should not happen, and this is the great lesson of the crucifixion, isn't it? That if things should not go our way all the time, And if there should be extreme difficulties in our lives, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If we are known to God and we have Jesus in our lives, because God will remember us. And that was the message of the resurrection.